what? Representative Bachmann. Let me...
No smoking.
For the... That's right, no smoking. your bill may be in jeopardy if you smoke it.
Right. Smoke at your own risk. And your bill.
The, for the benefit of the committee members, if you're not aware of it, I admit, I did not realize it was possible to make this bill retroactive. I've been advised by council, both legislative council and other council, that it is possible to make it retroactive. Now, this is a bill, to recall, that immunes county courts from lawsuits as a result of spending more than their tax levy, a budget greater than the amount that is accumulated through their tax levy. And I had calls and have explained to several people that this is a kind of an antiquated statute, that its obvious purpose was to prevent counties from incurring indebtedness, and therefore by spending more than the amount of taxes they accrued. And this was long before the state and the federal government contributed money, put money into counties, and therefore our counties now are spending money in excess of their amount, in excess of their tax levies, but at no specific burden upon the local taxpayers. And however, this old statute makes them, at least technically, victims of lawsuits. And I've been subsequently informed that it's possible to make this retroactive. And that's what these amendments, among other things, are aimed to do. Representative Offer.
Are there any questions? Chairman, you've really stated most of the things that I wanted to say today. This statute, 294-105, is an anachronism. It can be used in a vicious way, I think, against the local governments across the state in a way that the legislature never intended it to be used. It was, I believe, passed in 1903. It's no longer useful. No local government, no government of any kind in Oregon can go into debt. If that's the concern...
There are other statutes that preclude that, is that correct?
Including the Oregon Constitution. And so it's not a question of being able to hold counties to a non-debt situation, because those other provisions clearly prohibit them from going into debt. This is a leftover, forgotten thing that's still in our statutes and has been used in one occasion in Washington County, my county, as another attempt at guerrilla warfare against county government. I'm here today to urge you to repass House Bill 2521 and add the additional language that keeps the county commissioners from being personally liable for spending over their levy. The plain fact of the matter is that there is no county of the population of that kind in the state of Oregon who isn't a setting duck for this kind of a suit. If you leave this on the statute books, what this says is that any county and the county commissioners thereof are personally liable if they receive federal funds, if they receive gasoline tax funds from the state of Oregon, if they receive anything and spend it over and above their own local levy. I don't see how in the world the legislature could possibly want to put county commissioners in counties of that population, 50,000 and above, in that kind of position. So what I'm asking you to do is to repass the bill with the additional language that protects the men and women who are serving county government and as county commissioners today, that exempts them from the personal liability incurred under this antiquated statute. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions of Senator
Meeker. The amendment,
I had these drafted.
Would you
You're thinking it's a matter of policy, Senator Meeker?
I'm just asking you his opinion.
Well, this is a policy, not a legal question, right?
Well, it seems to me that the citizens who sue the people, whoever is implied in the suit, have the right to do so. And if the legislature is entering into a rather shady area, not shady, but let's say a questionable area, when we pass amendments like this saying that the act is declared to be ineffective, even for previous liabilities.
Senator Meeker, what I would say to you is this. I think that some of the people who are here today will be able to make the case that when the passage of 1963 budget law revision, there's a real question as to whether or not the fact that this statute is on the books right now is not due to the oversight of legislative counsel. Clearly, the laws of Oregon do not intend for a county be held simply to its local property tax levy. Clearly, we've been legislating highway funds to county governments, other kinds of funds to county governments, since the county has been receiving federal funds. Clearly, it's not the intention of the legislature, never has been, except perhaps in 1903, to have those governments not receive and spend these funds, and more than that, not have those county commissioners personally liable for it. Now, I don't have a qualm in the world about suggesting these amendments to you, given that, and given the fact that in this county, in the case that you're talking about, five county commissioners are personally liable for it in a suit of $7 million. To me, I have no problem with these amendments that are going to correct that and correct the legislative oversight that made that suit possible.
Senator Meeker,
could you? I'm not going to go with that because I think the court probably is holding the same. I think the original intent was quite clear. It only does affect the property tax rate.
Then you should have no reason to worry about
it. I have a very deep philosophical pain of having the legislature enter into a suit brought by the citizens of this state in the court of law. And I don't think we should do that. One more question, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that there are constitutional prohibitions. What are the specific constitutional prohibitions against the county going to debt?
I don't think under the Constitution.
We're on 2521, John.
Senator,
and it's in your report it out.
Or any of the attorneys on the committee when I do the last. I believe I didn't bring a copy of the Oregon Constitution with me, but my understanding the Constitution says no government shall be able to go into debt in the state of Oregon.
Is that fine, John?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you mentioned statutes in the later on.
But if you have any qualms about this, what I would urge the committee to do is get a hold of legislative counsel.
You call Steve.
Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution, county debt limitation. No county shall create any debt or liabilities which shall singly or in the aggregate with previous debts and liabilities exceed the sum of $5,000, provided, however, counties may incur bonded indebtedness in excess of $5,000 limitation to carry out purposes authorized by statute. Such bonded indebtedness not to exceed limits fixed by statute.
There are amendments, John. What make a retroactive?
If you have any,
could you identify again?
Section 10. Do you have any qualms about what other laws or constitutional provisions there are that operate in this area? Ask legislative counsel and get the question answered. I'm sure you'll find that budget law and combination of other laws prohibit that. And again, I have no qualms in entering into the personal case. Because it's through the legislative oversight that this pickle has been created. The county commissioners are in the pickle here today. Through our oversight.
Senator Carson.
Perhaps Mr. Sullivan can respond to this, but maybe you know less. In 1903, how many counties were over 50,000? I'll bet Oklahoma County was the target of this one. Any reason why it would be?
Marion County, however, today.
Oh, I'm well aware. Both Marion and Lynn, yes, I'm aware of that. My point was to be, I wonder what the rationale, if you know the history, why 35 counties, or there were less counties at that time, could go ahead and do what they're doing now, free of suit. But but 1903, they didn't want Multnomah County to do it.
I really have no idea.
I questioned the constitutionality.
And I'm Multnomah County legislator.
I wonder if that was...
It really seems odd, doesn't it?
Yes, because we don't say...
Can't we raise that to county's over 300,000?
One question this committee has asked a number of times about this bill and about a number of others that have been brought by Washington County. And I believe it would be one of the tools in defense against this lawsuit. And this probably doesn't apply to Washington County anyway, because you're a home rule county.
Well, if that's the case, let's just talk about non-home rule counties. Over the counties. Should this statute be on the books there? Because they're in the same, and have the same home rule.
Would you object to amendments which would have this bill speak to what you and I both agree the original intent was for, only property tax? Since the time the property tax was enacted and used as a method of planning and both revenue, we've come along with the gasoline tax, cigarette tax, and a number of others. Would you support that kind of change to this law, keeping in mind that there is a lawsuit pending?
I'm not sure what the change is. I didn't understand what you're suggesting.
That the liability can only extend your annual property tax levy and has nothing to say about excess revenue or other revenue.
I still don't understand what you're saying. Sorry, maybe I missed it.
I think what Senator Meeker is referring to is that the original statute. At the time the original statute was passed, apparently the only source of revenue was ad valorem tax levy. And his question is, would you have any objection if the amendment, if the bill was amended so that it would make the county commissioners liable if they spent any monies that exceeded the ad valorem tax levy, except where they have the money in hand from other sources.
I still want to know how you do that.
I think that's the question.
Well, how is it possible to sort
it out? How is it possible?
Sort it out.
How is it impossible? It's a known factor what your property tax is, and it's a known factor what gasoline tax revenue is. Spend more money than these. That's what the intent of the law was in the beginning.
Well, I think.
Okay, now wait. Let's do this. Let's just take just a hearing now, and so let's ask the questions, answer the questions from the witnesses, and we'll get into a work session on the.
I have no more.
Okay. Further questions of the witness.
Les, are you satisfied that if we put a retroactive clause on here?
That's been my advice I've received. I don't know, this is a question for attorneys, I guess, but I wonder if this bill failed to pass, whether that would have any bearing in terms of legislative intent on that court case.
Well, I think if I was counsel, I sure as hell argue.
I think I would too.
Well, so would I. We've got Steve Haas coming up. He drafted the amendments. We have Ed Sullivan, County Counsel from Marshall County here. Frankly,
I mean, if I were the attorney on the other side, I would argue that that's exactly the way I feel, and I think it's another reason to pay even more serious attention to what I had always considered when I was in the House to be a House bill, and I think it's clearly beyond that realm.
All right, there are further questions to it. Thank you. Ed, are you here to testify on these amendments?
Chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners, speaking for the Board of Commissioners. The only thing that I would point out to the committee at this point in time, perhaps a minor point, but I think the attorneys would appreciate it, and that is that the county council has also been sued, which makes it necessary for us to go to outside counsel to defend this case. And I think Senator Burns both know that they don't work for nothing. And appropriate and is in the interest of economy and government, and could argue it on that basis as well. Senator Meeker, on your point, if you're wishing to put a double lock on us not spending more than the property tax levy, I think we could certainly go along with that.
You mean without having funds from other sources to...
Well, we would certainly not spend more than the property tax levy from the property tax source. And I think that's...
You don't have any problems or qualms about having the legislature disenfranchise this group of people who have brought suit against you?
I wouldn't have chosen those words because I think that it's perfectly proper for the legislature to pass Security back. Every legal opinion that I've received suggests that that's possible. And from a policy matter,
I don't doubt the fact that it's possible.
And from a policy matter, I have no qualm whatsoever.
Are there further questions? Thank you. Ed, did you draft these amendments, Steve?
Sure.
Pardon me? Can you? Have you seen the amendments, Steve? Are you familiar with this?
These are the amendments that Jane and I discussed.
Oh, you and Jane discussed. Okay. All right. So it's my off the seat of my pants opinion was when I first heard about this that I had doubts that it'd be legally possible to go back. And then every lawyer that has great wisdom in this area has disabused me. I think the committee would like some discussion on that. We're able to see.
Well, just let me you're satisfied that that section 2 is a precedent for that. I mean, I support it and I think we ought to put it in, but
Senator, there may be precedent. In fact, there is lots of precedent for curative acts and by way of validation after the fact, by way of extinguishment of any liability before that liability is incurred in court. We do that all the time. In special district law, very
well. It hasn't been my experience to see an open proposed curative act after the.
We discussed it briefly. The point that I'm trying to put forward here is that you're extinguishing liability for which a court case has already been filed. Now, you know, the old law, the one legislature not binding the other, I think would fit here as well. One legislature determines that there should be no liability in this section and wants to go back and extinguish any liability that may have been incurred under that section. So be it. I'm a little bothered myself about extinguishing liability after court case has been filed, but I haven't read the case yet. And I'm bothered about it, let me make it perfectly clear, only because of the fact that I've very seldom seen the extinguishment. In fact, I've never seen the extinguishment on a court case pending.
Well, I have another question, Mr. Chairman, and that is that I wonder by the language of subsection 2 if we aren't acknowledging that there is liability, where we say any personal liability incurred, and if an advocate might say, well, the legislature acknowledged that those guys incurred liability, look at the language of their curative amendment.
Well, I don't think there's any argument that under the subsection 1 that's being stricken in the bill, there certainly was potential liability. Potential liability.
We could add the word allegedly.
Yeah, I would. It hasn't yet been decided by a court of law.
No, that's right.
It wouldn't be right for us to assume that they're guilty before they're. Well, that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make our legislative attempt not to be a constitutional.
Are there further questions, Mr. Hawk? Thank you, Steve. Ed Sullivan? I know you don't want to get up there, but I want you up here. Have you researched this?
You have a good attorney. We have Carol Brennan. He's a good attorney.
He loves law firm.
I've not...
Identify yourself on the table, yet.
The chairman. My name is Ed Sullivan. I'm the Washington County Council. No, I have not researched this particular point. Steve said, I think there is precedent for validating prior actions which might have been incorrect at one time.
I think that
this falls in the line of this validating action, and I'm satisfied that the wording is prepared by the Legislative Council because the...
You want to hold 1 second, Ed?
I'm satisfied that the wording...
You want to speak to this?
Yes. I'm satisfied that the wording prepared by Legislative Council accomplishes the objectives of its drafters. May I also speak, Mr. Chairman? There are, I think, 9 counties involved. 4 of them are home rule counties, 5 of them are not. 5 of them are not include...
Now, what do you mean, involved?
Well, that would be potentially liable. Yes. A substantial number of them, more than half, are non-home rule counties. Some of those are receiving O&C money. And O&C, that's the forest yield tax. And these two would be in the same position. Douglas Lane, as I understand it, has a $30 million budget and only has $1 million in property taxes. So I think that Lane County has a $30 million budget and $1 million levied in property taxes.
One, where the other 29
million? O&C, federal grants, state grants. Yes, I tried to go to the state legislative archives, and unfortunately, as I'm sure Steve will tell you, they burned in 1936 when the Capitol burned. I tried to research the newspapers of the day, and I didn't find anything in there except, you know, just a recitation of what was going on.
Did you check Cecil Edwards?
That's all I could find.
So you don't know
about Joseph Edberg of 36?
No.
What do you think of this law?
I think it was meant to cure a specific evil, probably just in Multnomah County. Commissioners spending in excess, for one reason or another, of their property tax levy. It was felt because of the disparity of the population section that evils existed in Multnomah County. I don't know why, and I don't know what happened at the time with the Multnomah County Court. I just don't know what the problem was.
Are there further questions?
The law was revised in 63, and apparently the subsection 1 just stayed there. I don't know why either.
Now, you say the law is revised.
Yes, subsection 2 was revised. They had a millage rate in subsection 2 of that law, and they changed it to a percentage rate or changed the figures, and they left subsection 1 alone. I did research also the decisions under it, and apparently there's only an AG's opinion.
Subsection 2 of what?
of the 294-105, which remains. See, there's a figure in there.
Okay, the order to direct the special levy to be made not exceeding 1/80th of 1% of 2 tax values.
Yes. Stoyles.
Well,
excuse me.
I don't understand what that got to do with section 1.
Well, subsection 1 was not changed in 63 when they revised that law. And I don't know why. No, I'm just saying that it was passed upon and nothing was done to subsection 1 at the time when subsection 2 was revised.
What? There was a. When did the, if you know, the, what do you call it, the budget?
Local budget law?
Yeah, when did that pass? 1963 also.
It was revised substantially in 63.
That probably should have been the time when this thing got there. Okay. Are there further questions?
Thanks.
Are there other witnesses here on 2521?
Gentlemen, I didn't know it was a public hearing.
It really isn't. It's a work session, but we've been rather accommodating everybody else. I want to be accommodating to you too. You want to come on up? We'll be brief like the other witnesses were.
Okay.
Except for questions.
You want my name?
Yes, on the record.
My name is Jane Button from Portland. I am against House Bill 2521.
Did you testify before?
Yes, I did. So did
that's right.
This other gentleman.
Ask a question.
Okay. I wonder if I could present a question to you gentlemen. How are you going to limit spending if this bill is passed? How are we going to control spending in the counties?
Well,
do you have an answer?
Yeah, budget.
When are we going to, how do we limit the budget?
Same way they do now, and what, 28 of the counties in Oregon, they don't come in this one.
But if the general public doesn't come out to these hearings, then where is the limitation according to law going to be placed upon on the budget in the counties?
Basically, they can't spend any more than they can raise from all sources, and that's still the law.
But when you get to federal revenue sharing, there isn't much limitation, is there? And that's being used. So I caution you gentlemen about this bill the way it is right now. I don't believe you fully realize what you're going to, and if you pass this bill, what you're going to hamstring your taxpayers with.
You're going to hamstring what?
Your taxpayers.
Senator Carter.
Jane, isn't it true, though, that hamstring the taxpayers, there is one county in the state of Oregon that is adhering to this law?
I'm sorry, that is very true.
So, from the status of where the taxpayer would be from prior to the litigation, the taxpayer himself would see no difference from before or after pending a suit.
But we'd like to see a difference.
Yes.
I speak for the taxpayers. We would like to see spending controlled and not go out of bounds. And we feel that there are a lot of programs that are funded by federal revenue sharing that are not necessary.
Senator Carter,
do you think spending ought to be a function of the property tax? In other words, that poor counties ought to have less to spend, even though they could give state money based on true cash value on the levy.
Well,
and wealthy counties that have a lot of industry spend higher.
I'll ask you another question. I won't answer that right now, but I'll say this. What is government for? What is the purpose of government? Is it to plan for people, or is it to protect the people? That's right. And the service, that's right. So therefore, a lot of this money that is going out is going in useless planning that the public doesn't even want. Now, I know this. I meet the public. I'm a taxpayer. And I think you should take this in consideration.
Well, the point I'd ask, though, Jane, is not disagreeing with you, Senator Burns' service question, is the way to get at that problem by going directly to the county commissioners or the city council or the state legislature, or is it by such statutes as this that really are overall, and for instance, they could still spend on plan, they could take, within this, they could take all their money and spend it on plan, which I understand your background on that, they could still violate, if you will, the wishes of the people under this statute, because this doesn't control spending on planning, this controls overall spending.
That's right, but they wouldn't be able to waste quite so much as they will be if we pass this the way you people have suggested here. Now, I realize times are different than they were in 1903, but government is getting pretty top-heavy, and I think it's time that we watch these laws, and I think you should take a little more time to study this over and come up with a better plan and a little more public hearing on it, I believe.
Senator Burns, is a justification in your mind for the difference between 50,000 residents on a farm? Now, if this law applies only to 50,000, the county that can have 50,000 people or more, doesn't apply to the 28 that have less than 50,000. Do you think that there's a
judge? I doubt they're picking up on that.
All right. Do you think that there's a valid reason for limiting this only to the larger counties?
I really don't know what that reason was.
Well, you're addressing yourself to the bill now, and you don't want the bill passed. So if you don't want the bill passed, you're in effect in agreement with perpetuating this distinction between larger and smaller counties. Do you have a reason for that?
Not necessarily. That's the way the law was at that time, and of course, we had very little to do with writing it. Well, I think there should be some kind of limitation in the counties. Yes, I do, because I'm for limited government. I think that that when government becomes top-heavy, it does waste money and it does spend more money. And I think that government today was set up to protect the landowner and the taxpayer. That was the purpose of our government. And it hasn't been revised yet, or it hasn't been, we don't have a new constitution yet.
They do have limited government in Washington County, we know that. You know, commissioners out there are part-time, they only get, I think, $250 a month, as compared to what they get in Washington County.
I'd rather see hired paid commissioners and less money spent, and really get down to the basics of our government. If they do a better job, yes, but if they're going to waste our money, I don't think they deserve more money. I'm not for limiting their wages, but if they accomplish a good job and do a good job. But the way you've got it set up with your recommendations here and your changes, there's not going to be any limitations at all. I think you should have more public hearings on this and get the people involved and rather than rush this through.
Are there further questions? Thank you very much.
And I thank you.
Okay. Senator Meeker, did you want to have an amendment that would...
You asked him this morning?
No, I asked him last week.
Yeah. We'll pull this over and put this on for Thursday morning, that's the morning after Wednesday night.
Yeah. All right,
let's go to 507.
Thank you, Mr. Howe.
Thank you.
I'll tell you. 507, do a U-turn.
There's a story.
wonder if there are five of those standards.
Okay,
all right. What's your agenda?
My agenda is in front of me. All right, on the bill, you have some amendments here on that. Recall our problem.
We're going to parallel it.
Pardon me?
We're going to parallel it. Redesign it. Okay. In other words, it speaks to A and B, and we're going to redesign it so that the A has the lead in, or the lead line, and A and B look more similar if the amount of people that the taxes do. And all that.
Okay. You look at yours?
No, I haven't.
Whatever you say.
Who drew the
D, or probably my D?
Steve.
I know. Do you know what the problem is on John?
The
507?
No. Okay. No, but I whatever you want.
The what occurs is that they end up with these little narrow strips of land and so forth, and they have to go through the form of sale procedure, and you get spike purchases and various other things where every self-desirable is letting the property owners ought to have the first crack at it. You have in the testimony that in the city of Porter, for instance, where there have been plots set up and they've missed a 20-foot strip and it goes on for 2 or 3 miles. And because of the development, one went up, didn't go the legal description didn't meet the lines of the previous development, so they have these strips of land going there, and itself is the ideal way to dispose of it, but the budding property owners split the land if they want to, or sell rather than have to put it out for sale and have somebody come in and buy it just to spite thing against somebody who may be down the street with. And what our problem has been, we started out by letting the county commissioners do it. It was under $1,000, but our concern was in eastern Oregon, a piece of land worth $1,000 could involve several acres.
Right.
And so we're trying to reduce it down to minimum amounts of land so that there it can't be abused by county commissioners.
Well, yeah, I voted against this earlier because there have been some instances in the past of county commissioners abusing the property.
Yeah, well, I think what we're trying to do now is to carve it down to what the original intent legislation was. And that's what we hope these amendments do. And so what we use is if the property acquired is insufficient in size or used for building purposes under local ordinance.
Mr. Chairman, I realize we're going to have to get this bill out, but and I'm not, I guess I'm quibbling, but my concern is that it really didn't parallel, and
these amendments don't do it?
Well, it starts out, for instance, and what I'm trying to do is engross in my mind, and that's not easily done by my mind. I have no objection up to the, as follows. Then A starts out, and it speaks to whom you may convey it, to the record owner. Okay, then let's drop down to B, and now, rather than start out to any person, it says, may convey as follows, any property acquired. In other words, you have the subject and the object mixed in parallel language, and there ought to be an or, at any rate, seems to me, in a semicolon between after valid, or after such purchase, or whatever the, we're taking out lines 12 and 13, I think, I should have been out, at least 10 through 21, yeah. So it stops at 10. Yeah, after the county on the amendment, I think there ought to be a semicolon or, and then it really ought to read something to the effect either paralleling A or B would be to the record owners of property abutting such property so acquired, or to purchasers of any such abutting property under recorded contract for sale, any property acquired by the county for delinquent taxes. I think maybe the
I
I think your point about that would be.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to offer.
And then as soon as it's ready, we'll bring it back. Okay. John, do you have problems with public meeting on your group?
What you're using? If you're satisfied, I think. Well, if you do that, as soon as it's ready, we'll put it back on the agenda. Why don't we put it on the agenda for a week hence, but if it's ready before then, we'll top it on.
Okay.
Just so we don't lose. You got that here? Let's look at and we have a hearing set on 2320. Is anybody here? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, are you taking the action on 2001?
I want to wait until Steve gets back. She's got for a minute. Connie Singer on 2320.
Good morning. My name is Connie Singer, and I reside in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a resident of public housing and the president of the Tenant Advisory Council, which was, in fact, in back of the writing of this bill 2320. I've given testimony three or four times on this bill, and when we started out, it was a simple little tenant commissioner bill, and we thought it was very easy to work with. Well, in the writing of this bill, perhaps we forgot about some of the problems that do occur with the commissioners, and one of those being the handling of the grievance procedure. It's our understanding that this bill has caused more commotion because of the amendment to the grievance procedure. After polling at a random sampling of the tenants in public housing, we find that the tenants want this amendment very badly left in this bill. We have no...
Okay, so I want to make sure what you're talking about. You want the amendment
as
in
to
the bill at present time?
Yes, we do, sir.
On the grievance procedure?
Yes, we do. And if you would like, the reason for that being, we have no protection, actually, from HUD as far as the lease and grievance procedure goes. And we feel that this bill will help substantiate it with the housing authorities. We are having a meeting in Portland next week on this grievance procedure. We have been working without a fair grievance procedure in Portland for a year and a half. The only testimony I feel that I really have left to give this morning is to encourage this committee to accept the bill as it stands. I've discussed it with Mr. Rosenbaum, as I understand some of you have, and I think this bill, not only to encourage tenant commissioners, but to encourage the protection of the tenants is important.
Are there questions of Senator Carter?
Mr. Singer, does Portland Housing Authority now have some sort of grievance procedure?
Some sort of a grievance procedure.
Not as outlined as this, but that's what I understand.
The grievance procedure Portland now uses was taken from a model lease and grievance procedure, but it is not what we are looking at here.
You know, offhand, and I can find out elsewhere whether other housing authorities throughout the state have grievance procedures or not.
Oh, some do and some don't. This was put in especially with Representative Lindquist put this in for actually the protection of the Clackamas County. I was a little hesitant about it, quite honestly, at first, because I was afraid that, as I say, it was a simple little bill, and I was afraid it might incur a little, and apparently it has. I've tried to look at all the ramifications that this could have, and when I hear housing authorities say there is no business for a grievance procedure, perhaps not, because you see the commissioners, in fact, do sit, if you will, as the fair hearings officer in a grievance procedure, the chairman of the board. And with this grievance procedure in here, we will be able to vote as to which one of these parts of the three-member and impartial hearing officer and three-member panel, or someone not affiliated with the housing authority at all, as to which it should be.
Are there further questions? Senator Meeker.
I wonder, you're probably much more familiar with this bill than I am in its first reading, but I wonder if you could comment on the effect that this would have in a housing authority that primarily is in the business of leasing micro housing. Because I see on line 27, page 29, 30, on page 2 of the bill, that you see.
Yes. Well, I understand your question. It says that, you know, at least 25 units must be occupied, or 75% of the units available for occupancy.
Are occupied.
Yes.
The reason I ask the question is, over what period of time must they be occupied? A year, a month, a week? Because you could...
Oh, you're talking about the transit problem. Is this what you're getting to?
Exactly.
I think that the people appointed to these positions would be at the approval of the city county commissioner or what have you. The time element on this just says that they must be a tenant within the Housing Authority of Portland or whatever county. But as soon as they leave housing, they are no longer naturally. I think there are going to have to be, yes, alterations made on this specific point. Quite honestly, we didn't take that into consideration.
You see, let me draw an example for you. There is a housing authority in Yamhill County.
Yes.
And that housing authority runs the Yola Village.
Yes.
And the Yola Village has, I think it's 40 or 50 units. Now, for a three-month period, they'll be 100% occupied.
Yes.
But in the winter months, they'll maybe be 20% occupied.
Right.
During what period of time do we measure the occupancy, number one? And number two, what is the length of term for one of the appointees? I do see some problems here.
I see your point there. It would be difficult for me to answer that question, quite frankly, at this time. I feel that I'm wondering, perhaps I might do some research on as to the amount of grievances that have been handled through these particular instances, or how their grievance procedure is, or how their commissioners work.
Right. Mr. Chairman,
let me go ahead.
My concern is not with the grievance portion at this time.
It's with the tenant, period, on the commission, is that correct?
Well, yeah, because I don't see how it's going to work for those.
Well, then perhaps in some counties it wouldn't work in yeah. where you have such a transit county. I think that would have to be taken into consideration.
All right, thank you.
Let me ask you one question there. Apparently a problem arises where you have, it isn't just grievances against the housing authority.
Mm-hmm.
There are grievances between tenants, one tenant against another, and apparently there's a reluctance, however, for tenants to testify against other tenants, because just like it is with neighbors, a lot of times you take a lot of stuff for a long time because you're going to be living next door to each other for a long time, and you don't like to meddle, so to speak.
I know what you're going to say.
And they have great difficulty getting people in to testify. Now, does this address itself with that problem?
Senator Burns, this whole grievance procedure was made not to have grievances against the housing authority, but to protect the tenant against the tenant in a housing authority complaint against another tenant. We're not speaking about a grievance procedure to the housing authority. I realize we've had to bring some of our tenants in the back door to testify and get them out the same way. This is the same procedure that is used in the HUD manual. This is why I can't understand the concern all of a sudden from housing authority. This grievance procedure was not directed to grievances against the housing authority. It is grievances pertaining to tenant complaints against tenants on eviction matters. There is no reason why the same procedures cannot be used if this amendment is in this bill or if it is in fact adopted by a housing authority in a grievance procedure.
Let me ask you something. Now, you serve on a tenant advisory council.
I do.
And this is the one there in
Is this statewide, or is this just there?
The Tenant Advisory Council is in Portland, Oregon, and we try to represent the people in public housing as much as HAP will allow us.
And you live in Portland?
I do.
Are you in?
Yes.
What did they do?
District 8. Oh, in Portland, yes.
Okay. We're going to put this back on for a hearing next Tuesday, and we're going to have somebody in the House of Authority in Portland here.
Yes.
And if it's possible, I'd like to have you come back.
Oh, I will be here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here to testify on 2320? Let's go to
Mr. Chairman. With the housing authorities, I don't think they can fail on housing authority. Will they notify it, or are they aware?
I don't think anybody was specifically notified. I gather they're following the legislative session here. Why don't you want? Would you like to have them specifically notified?
Yeah,
we'll add that. We'll add that. And
Jake come under this, and Tony's raised some interesting questions. Maybe they don't care about this.
Tony, are you talking about the Salem Housing Authority?
No, the Yandell County Housing Authority.
All right.
And Mr. Chairman, to add the sideline on, the Yandell County Housing Authority runs the Yola Village, which is a migrant county. And the occupancy figures here do present a problem for that kind of facility.
Right. We'll specifically notify the Salem Housing Authority, the Yandell County Housing Authority. Is there anybody else? Clackamas County watches it very closely. I'm sure they know about it. Jerry, you want to say something?
Mr. Chairman, I was chairman of the Marion County Housing Authority for 3 years until last December. Served on some of these appeals for it. The Marion County Housing Authority does have procedure, and you might want to have the director of the Housing Authority explain
that. Senator Carson?
Mr. Chairman, I hope it's incumbent upon them to. Because if we adopt this, if their old procedure, if it doesn't match this, it's going to have to be changed. And I don't know whether they haven't gotten the word or they think this is a grand deal. There's several conclusions we could draw. Some might be very comfortable for them, and some might be disastrous.
From my experience with housing authorities, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carson, I think they're probably not informed of what's going to be doing.
Well, the Housing Authority of Portland knows about it.
I'm sure that's true, but
I'm sorry,
sir.
Would you make
that last
hand?
The Housing Authority
Board
was not informed?
Oh, no.
I say they're aware of this bill.
Gotcha.
And they're following the legislative session.
If I may, the Tenant Advisory Council has informed, I don't know how many different counties, they are well aware of this bill. And for their, quite honestly, it's a comfortable thing for them, as far as we're concerned, not to respond to this. Comfortable now, but it won't be later.
Well, we'll notify them. They don't show up the next time. I give us some indication we got it. Very interesting. Let's go to this county assessor thing now. Down on 2298. We take up a candidate, don't we?
Yeah.
2298, HJR 22.
We got them both here? Or?
Yeah, we got them both here. Is there anybody here on those? Jerry?
Jerry's here to answer questions.
Were you here on the county assessor bills?
Yes.
Okay, we got them all over here now. We got both of them. We got House Bill 2298, and we got HJR 22 over here.
Yes, well, I asked for another bill to be brought over, which.
On county assessors?
No, on certified appraisers, which I think affects.
Oh, that's right. Okay, I forgot about that.
And then I think, Mr. Chairman, you were also given the examination, were you not?
It's here somewhere.
Well, I wonder if Herb Perry is a certified appraiser.
He
is.
No.
Didn't we go through this last?
That question was raised last time.
I wasn't here. One of you meetings.
Yeah. No, I thought you raised that. Somebody raised that.
I think
you,
I read.
Or you read mine.
Under the present situation of a certified appraiser, it's
hold up, just a second, Jerry. Let's look and see if we got this. Have we got that information here?
It's a very simple examination.
The present one.
Almost just a general knowledge check. And I'm not the brief for this. I don't have a brief for that particular.
Does he have a car?
Qualification. It's just that we're trying to find some basic upgrade qualifications. This real estate appraisal one.
Jerry, I can't hear you.
Oh. I was just talking to Senator Burns. Are you ready?
Well, no. Anything you say here, we all hear.
He asked whether.
Get your name on the record.
Excuse me. I'm Jerry Bartz, Tax Division, Department of Justice, representing the Department of Revenue in their concern for the assessors. And I say that because we do have an overall duty. The Department of Revenue has an overall duty to supervise the system of taxation throughout the state under the statute, and for that reason they're very concerned that assessors are qualified to do their job. And one of the things that was not mentioned the last time, I think, and is very important, is that the assessor's job is a real hot spot in the county. And because of the way it has been handled in the past and things that have occurred, the legislature has gotten a great deal of criticism on tax matters because the people that are out there on the front line, which are the assessors, are the ones that are getting criticism for the way they handle their job. And when that occurs, it's the legislature that is being criticized for the kind of tax laws. And the resulting backlash is that we're having trouble with the tax bills. I think this is one factor that ought to be considered.
Jerry, we looked through, I think it's this deal here. In the Revenue Committee, we went through and we found that there was no exceptions, I recall, that the assessors were not within 10% of the true cash value. And we have testimony on other bills where they say that if you're within 10%, you're well within the ballpark because any appraiser can vary as much as 10%. And so we find that all the assessors do have the true cash value within 10% of the, they appraise the property within 10% of the true cash value. Now that's the revenue department's own statistics. So if they're doing as good a job as the best appraisers in the business, then why do you have to have these qualifications?
Well, this is a constant fight, of course, and that isn't true in the that's a general a generalization in the first place.
What I said?
Well, yes, it's a general statistic.
From the Department of Revenue.
That's right, but it's a general statistic that they're within 10%,
each county.
Yes, I realize that. But I mean, you've got a problem of different classes of property. The thing is, you're getting the use of computers in these counties. And you're getting a system of taxation of 100% of true cash value, and you're getting you're adding each time duties to the assessor's office, and the assessor should be somebody that is capable of management in his office.
Well, wait a minute. What does being appraiser got to do with being capable of management?
In the larger counties, certainly, you would want to have your assessor have some background in appraising, or at least some knowledge of what appraising is.
What difference does it make a per variance appraiser?
Well, I think it's important that anybody that supervises somebody else knows something about the job that's being done. That's generally true.
Chairman, wouldn't it be smarter to give all counties home rule authority and get away from perpetuating the office of assessor? Do you have evidence that responsibility for handling better in counties which have assessors and in home rule counties which have been organized on a management basis?
None that I know of. I don't think there's been any study to that direction. It's a historical development. You have assessors throughout the counties there.
Except in the home rule counties. But my problem is I don't think we need assessors.
Oh, we gotta have a session.
I know. Yeah, right.
My old dad wouldn't have had a job 16 years.
You wouldn't have been able to feed all those dogs.
Well, yeah, they're very worded.
I had much of a job if all you ever had was tickets.
$125 a month during the break was a good job.
As I would like, think it would be unfortunate if you were hung up on this certified appraiser qualification in here. And in the first place, as we pointed out at the last hearing, HGR 22 has to do with the qualifications being set by the legislature and as a constitutional amendment, and that's what we really consider important. What the specific qualifications are I think something that could even be left for an interim study, for that matter, but the that.
Chairman, I very well may be logical, and you might be correct, but I don't think you're practical in my judgment, because we've had gambling bills, and I went through the sheriff's bill 2 years ago, and your argument may be sound, but it is, I don't think it'll get across the floor of the Senate, that we're going to require some qualifications, and we'll get to that later. I don't think it'll work. I may be wrong. It might be worth a try. In other words, take 22 and run with it, and let an interim study or a 75 session come up with qualifications.
Well, look at these qualifications in House Bill 2298. One is the certified appraiser, which, if you're not familiar with the examination, I think the chairman has it.
We have it.
It's almost a general information test, and it's not at all a critical. Anyone that's reasonably literate can pass that examination.
What bill are you looking at?
2298.
2298.
Well, that's the only qualification.
Only qualification that you have.
What?
That's the only one that's left.
Well, yeah, but the point is that we've got a bill, or had a bill, on being a certified appraiser that was all over the ballpark. Where is that bill?
That's the other one that was brought in here.
So, Wally, what are you talking about?
Well, didn't we have a bill on certified appraisers? Or what was the other one we had over there?
Yeah, then they're all competing between themselves.
Yeah,
the money.
Yeah.
I think it's on the BD section of the book.
There are different ways to be a certified.
Yeah, depending on what society.
This other bill that was brought up, I think, isn't it 2301? It was brought over. It was in the Revenue Committee and was brought over.
Well,
I called your clerk
about it. Craig, was that here? We had a hearing on the Revenue Committee, but here we had a hearing on.
Well, we had one somewhere where we had the appraisers representing the various societies
way down.
And it just kind of unraveled when the disagreement came on what society ought to be the authority to allow one to be appraised.
George, why don't you come up here?
George, what was the
bill, the present bill as to certified appraisers has a new system under which there's a trainee appraiser and then there's a professional exam, which has been incorporated in that new bill. And I ask your clerk to bring that over here for you.
Okay, do we have a copy of 2310?
2301.
2301,
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman.
Well, wait a minute, here's what's called. The one we had was 417. Senate Bill 417, which happens to be in the table section.
Right.
Yeah, that one.
Where they wanted to create State Board of Appraisers.
that really had nothing to do with county appraisers or certification.
That's right.
Well, why didn't it?
Because they weren't included in that.
They were exempt.
Who was exempt?
County appraisers.
Government employees.
Government employees are exempt from that bill.
Well, did you think that Herb Perry ought to be a certified appraiser?
Oh, wait a minute. 417 says, talking about appraisals, that a certified appraisal is a real property pursuant to RS 308-210 should be formed either by either a certified appraiser described in ORS 308-010, which is the same site that we have in this bill. So, well, that's neither here nor there. If we got a better bill than 417, then take a look at it. Do we have a copy?
Well, 2301
is the one.
2301 is the one, and it was pretty well torn apart over in the House. But what it primarily speaks to now is 2301, is that they allow the county to set up a training program, provides for a training period for people that cannot qualify to meet the standards set for certified appraiser. It gives them a 2-year training period. If they can't hack the exam at the end of that time, bam, out they go. And this is going to, I hope, give the assessors access to some pretty good people that can't qualify right at the moment.
Did you state your name on that?
George Miller, Department of Revenue. Sorry.
Our clerk still has to do that.
Mr. Chairman, you wanted if Herb Perry was certified. I'm not sure whether he is or not, but I'll guarantee you that he would have no difficulty in passing the examination for certification.
Well, see, Mr. Chairman,
may I? Senator Clark.
I don't know Mr. Herb Perry, so
I know him better than George does, but longer.
Well,
I don't know.
My point is, without saying that, what I'm worried about is if...
Me too.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
You didn't
mean. John and I both served with him as the deputy district attorney in Baltimore County.
My point is, I don't know him. I don't know his qualifications, so that's fine. What I want to know is, it seems kind of funny when everybody assures me the first track to qualify because the appraisal requirements are so minimal.
Yeah.
The whole doggone bill is to get higher qualifications for appraiser. We just got a full circle.
But he must remember that some of the minimal candidates that come up for this office, in these smaller counties particularly, aren't even... You know, even a simple exam and maybe beyond them. And then they're still eligible for election to the office.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, what's really the heart of the whole matter, based on your comment, I read the same report from the Department of Revenue, and based on the testimony we've heard before, the real problem is that the assessor politically is a very difficult or hot seat, and by trying to put some minimal requirements, we'll keep the politicians from running to the office of the assessor. I think that's what I'm hearing.
I hope not. I hope what you're hearing is that the whoever runs for the office, and it's certainly a broad enough spectrum under this bill, has to have some basic minimum qualification of literacy.
Of what?
Of literacy.
Well, that's required, because then we have to pass this exam.
Well, we think that you'd have to be reasonably literate to pass it.
I read the same thing that Senator Carson does, and it's the same thing we had a discussion on the floor of the Senate on district court judges. Some district court judges look at their court of record, put them in higher esteem, the view of some people as judges, and maybe give them a better salary. I disagree with that. But I do read that here, and I must say, the assessors came here and testified in favor of this bill were outstanding men, because they come before our Committee on Revenue and everything's been very helpful. But I feel as if they would like to have this in part for those reasons.
Well, two qualifications in here. One is this basic real estate appraisal one course, or a similar course, is a 2-week familiarization course, which is, well, I realize that, but the other is the 2 years office accounting and accounting experience, including experience in office management, or 2 years full-time employment in the office of the county assessor.
That's 2301.
No, I'm talking about 2298.
The original 2290.
These are the original qualifications that were asked for. Beg your pardon?
All
right. There was a qualification that he passed successfully, one of the basic real estate appraisal courses, and there are 3 or 4 given, and they're 2-week courses usually, and they're a familiarization thing with the field. The other two, the other alternatives are either 2 years of office and accounting experience, or 2 years full-time employment in the office of the county assessor as an alternative.
Those are alternatives to the real estate school.
Beg your pardon?
Those are alternatives to the real estate.
No, those are in addition to certified appraiser, the real estate school, and then one or the other of the office management.
You're referring to ORS 308-010.
Yeah, I've got it right here.
Yes.
And
it just requires passing the examination of property appraiser one.
And it has other merit. So it has other qualifications. What were you referring to?
Old 20. See, we got so many program amendment programs here, so we can tell one from another. The 2298 is originally introduced in the House before they tinkered with it.
This is what the assessors asked for originally.
these.
Sutter's on a better track than whatever committee that came out of the House.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meeker, I know it's probably difficult for you to answer, but could you relate for us a discussion on why the House committee amended everything out of that original bill and left only the certified appraiser business in there?
George has got the answer. Tell us, George.
Flat out, they were afraid it was going to restrict the number of people that would be available to run for office of assessor.
Did you have further questions?
Yes, I'm committee meeting open.
We went through the whole uniform version code yesterday. We were voting on that in great detail.
Senator Johnberg, right. Are there further questions? Are there other?
I'd like to have his.
Pardon me?
The original bill is a good bill.
Yeah, let's go back to 2298. Let's get a copy of 2301 and see if we can work something out.
Dean, get those and. We'll put this on for next Tuesday. And list those bills in parentheses back to the 2298.
2301
is a
right.
I don't have copies of the bill
in front of me. You don't want to try to get
that. And get the original 2298. Okay.
You don't want to try to get 2301 moved in the screen.
We can build it in power.
With the real property appraiser one, that's the one that's going to be reported. Real property one, appraiser test, or property appraiser test one, is that one you sent over?
We sent over the one for certified appraiser.
Yeah. John Parkhurst, I understand, brought it in to somebody. Now, whether he was able to leave it here or not, I don't know.
Yeah, apparently he did leave it. They just didn't want it copied because it's an exam they give.
Yeah, well, I haven't seen it. They keep pretty good control on it.
I haven't either.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, 3009. Steve? Steve, you got some amendments there on 3009.
Right.
Which, among other things, automatically refers all taxing measures to the voters, right?
All measures for the raising of revenue, tax
right.
Measures, yes.
Okay.
Well, the distinction being that you could still theoretically, under an ordinance, make the distinction between a license fee, for instance, that recovers the cost of administration, and a business tax, which is solely for the purpose of raising revenue. If you see the distinction,
that would be referred.
That's the classic distinction.
Well, what about some of these business license taxes that seem to be getting higher and higher? I don't mean about the license tax the lawyer pays, but some of the others. Now, where do you draw the distinction?
All right. You have to draw the distinction on a case-by-case basis, and you look at the old constitutional language when we talk about bills raising revenue. And there's a difference between raising revenue and charging a fee sufficient to cover the cost of your police power operation.
That's the best one on page 74, if I recall correctly. Right?
Is it? Thank you.
And this puts the other thing the amendments do is put
Dred Scott. Oh.
Put the language in the Constitution for referral of all ordinances adopted by the county.
We use the same formula of those who voted for governor in the last election.
Right.
All candidates.
Same percentages, 90 days, 160 days.
That's right.
Okay. A real people's bill.
Right.
Senator Carson moves the amendment.
Discussion. One stated May 25th.
May 25th.
That's right.
Discussion. All those in favor adopt the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, signify by saying no.
Move the bill.
Senator John Byrne moves the bill to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion, clerk call the roll.
Aye.
What a great first time said color. Which one? Byrne K?
Aye.
Byrne K?
Aye.
Parker?
Aye.
Sir?
Aye. Does anybody particularly want to carry the bill? I've picked up about three automatic no votes. You know.
Changed my vote.
I'll carry it. Welcome to if anybody wants to carry the can.
We might want to help you.
I know your help. We appreciate it. Yes. Okay, I'll carry the bill. Okay, now, let's see if we can do something on, let's look at 3091.
I got a whole panel full of amendments here.
On 3091? Do we have those before?
No, I'm a snooze. Do you like the surprise? I like the surprise, too.
When does that surprise come in?
Well, let's see. I don't have a second amendment.
What's your problem on this?
Don't run off, Steve.
No, I know, but I...
Did Steve for Mary Lee?
Yep.
Oh, all right.
Well, you weren't sure which ones I were popping on, right?
No.
No.
What do these do, Wally?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is the disadvantage of having a free 10 minutes. I started to worry about this bill, and what this bill does is basically puts in the penalty of false swearing. The major part of the bill appears on line 34
page
3. There's a slight change on line 13 of page 2 where they dropped it from a felony to a Class C misdemeanor. Now that's the warning statement that's going to go into petition.
Yeah.
We couldn't find in the operative section making false swearing or making what this says in the warning operative. So basically what you see here is an amendment to the bill that first of all matches the false swearing to the present Class A misdemeanor statute classification of false swearing. That's the First Amendment, first paragraph amends the relating to. Second paragraph changes it to a false swearing published for the Class A misdemeanor, which is the punishment for false swearing. The third paragraph is what I call the operative section and says, in fact, falsifying the petition is in fact false swearing and comes by the
Senator Carr moves the amendments for the discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Beaver.
No, it's not on the amendment, I'll wait.
All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed signify by saying no. The amendments are adopted. Senator Carr can move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Beaver.
I move that section sub A on page 3, which is lines 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 7, be reinstated.
On page 3,
yes.
Subsection A,
little a. And along with that amendment, we'll have to change the word any on page 3, sub 2, back. We have to reinstate that as well.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the consent motion would be the table of bills would really be more appropriate. I should check with Don Jones, but I think
you have some good additions to the
well, okay, I'll even if we do that, I don't know.
Tell us, Mr. Chairman, Senator Baker, sir.
Budget the hearing on this. Tell us why you want this reason.
Mr. Chairman, if we were to adopt this bill, then annexation and the discussion of it is accomplished simply by resolution on one hand and an affidavit on the other. There's no requirement now any longer if this bill were to be adopted that the landowners who are going to be the people that pay the taxes have any part in it.
Well, can I restate it?
This is for incorporation.
Well,
Well, let me restate it for a different vantage point. I don't disagree with Tony. The effect of this is there now, there's a back door for incorporating within the infected area or the urban area, urbanized area, which is defined in statute as what, 3 or 6 miles?
Don, why don't you come on up and read your bill?
No, that's another law. But if an incorporated or an area falls within the urbanized area, which is 3 to 6 miles, depending upon the size of the city that is within 3 to 6 miles or 4 or 6 miles, the area may incorporate by the process listed on page 3. The effect of the amendment is to say that if the adjacent city, urbanized city, disagrees or fails to answer, I'll put it that way, no incorporation. If the city agrees or the city fails to answer within 120 days, then the area may incorporate. But what it means, for all practical purposes, is that if the city within 3 miles of an urban area or 6 miles, an area within that, cannot incorporate without the permission of the city. That's simply what it is.
This bill doesn't speak to that law.
Yeah, that's it. That's the whole bill. By taking out A, right now, that's what B and C say. A says another way they can do it is in effect by half the landowners, the majority, the triple majority, whatever.
Is this an annexation?
No.
It's an incorporation bill, A.
I thought it was designed to discourage incorporation.
I thought that your amendment was designed to discourage incorporation too.
That's right. That's what
I mean, Senator Meeker's amendment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question? Where's the bill that we discussed the other day?
Well, we got that. That's on our agenda today too. Mm-hmm. We're moving it from triple 1/3 to triple 1/2. Is that the one we're talking about?
That could well be. That's House Bill 3105.
That's what our agenda is.
Yes. Let me
this?
Wait.
All right.
You have a problem?
No. I think we should discourage
incorporation. Is that?
I'll just a minute.
This one does, Senator Meeker. If I, for your tape, I'm Don Jones representing the League of Oregon Cities. Senator Meeker talked to me about a fact situation the other day, some community that's about 5 miles from McMinnville, which might choose to incorporate. And if this law were passed, it would require that McMinnville approve the incorporation of that city before the incorporation election could proceed. He raised some questions about the policy issue there, but I agree with him in his interpretation of how this would apply. Under present law, it would not be necessary to get McMinnville's approval because if they went ahead and met the requirement in subparagraph A here, a triple majority requirement.
Mr. Chairman, Senator
Meeker. I'd like to ask a couple
of questions.
Okay, let me just, that's right. Senator Carson's withdrawn his vote. I withdraw the floor. Senator Meeker moved the amendment, and we're discussing the amendment. Go ahead.
In many cases, the only way you can get a sewage system or grant a sewage system is if you are an incorporated city. Is that not true?
Well, that's one way. It's not the only way, by any means. There's a county service district law, or there's special districts which can be created to provide sewage service. It has been a factor in several incorporations, however. The need for sewage.
But if tariff, let's incorporate so we can get the federal money.
Or let's incorporate so we can solve the solid waste problem.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Meeker,
the intention of my amendment is to still allow this kind of procedure for incorporation. It's going to behoove any existing to deny incorporation of other cities. Because
because of the taxing and a number of other things, the way the law is written now on incorporation, a city 6 miles away of an area that attempts to incorporate with a population of 5,000 or more speaks to virtually every rural area in the state. Now I can see where this bill has some authority for urbanized areas. But here's a list of the newly incorporated cities. And those cities that were incorporated that we're talking about, like River Grove and Johnson City and Maywood Park, were all incorporated prior to the Distance and Boundary Commission. And I think the testimony we've had in this committee is that the Boundary Commission has discouraged and have prevented this kind of growth adjacent to other cities. And I don't think the act is needed in this form. That's why I made the amendment, Mr. Chairman. And I think with this amendment, we've made the petitioning and penalty section that Senator Carson has offered made the bill a good bill. My concern is not with the urbanized area at this moment, because the Boundary Commission has taken care of that problem. But if you do eliminate this method of incorporation, you have, in a sense, limited rural areas and how they can solve some of their problems.
Is there further discussion on the amendment? Don, I want to make sure I understand. Well, it seems to me that by the adoption of this amendment, it can be construed to make it more difficult to incorporate, because you got all the other language in there, plus taking A out, putting A back in, because that doesn't automatically allow them to incorporate by taking plus of A out.
But any city nearby doesn't have veto power, Mr. Chairman. Under this bill, if we eliminated A, any one, all the city has to do is veto. No
corporation. All right.
It would, in a sense, return it, I think, to the present procedure. That would be my understanding of Senator Meeker's amendment, Mr. Chairman.
That's right.
See, Mr. Chairman, this bill proposes, without my amendment, or says without my amendment, that the city of McMinnville, or any other city, could veto the incorporation of another city, even though it has nothing to do with the urban problem that's been presented in some of the testimony.
Okay, we're not going to take action on this bill today, but we are going to take action on this amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Those in favor of the amendment will signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed signify by saying no. No. The amendment is passed. Aye. We'll put this on the agenda for a week hence. All right. People got some bills to carry the floor this morning?
That must be your work.
Jim, were you here on Tinkerbell?
Thank you for inviting me. It's nice to see you.
How are you?
Good to see you. How are you?
How are you? How are
you? You made me right.
Here's the trouble right here.
This,
if we change this,